Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's take a look, hit the button, and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And boom, T-Rex, Electric Warrior.
Ooh.
Cool.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I think I can get into this. Okay, so Electric Warrior is a 1971 album by Mark Bolan's band T-Rex, their sixth since their debut as Tyrannosaurus Rex in 1968, and their second under the name T-Rex. The album marked a turning point in the band's sound, moving away from the folk-oriented music of the group's previous albums and pioneering a flamboyant, pop-friendly take on electric rock and roll known as glam rock. Mm-hmm. So this is, I guess, one of the first glam rock albums.
Yeah, it's certainly the first of their... What year did it come out?
71.
71, yeah, okay, that's pretty early.
All right, so without any further ado, let's get into the first song, which is called Mumbo Sun. Here we go. I need to be bought moon. I want to crew with you. Cool. That was kind of like a mid-tempo rock kind of thing. I don't know if I would necessarily open the album with it, but I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed a little bit unusual for an album opener, but actually, I've heard things like that used as an album opener, but usually they're not full-length tracks. Kind of, it works as like it's a groove that sort of introduces it or something like that. But I guess it can kind of works. It's not what you would think, but it would, I guess, kind of work. And I suppose it has worked because it's on this album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I liked about it, it's very bass heavy. It's very busy in the low end, and then the guitars are kind of on top, and then the vocals are right in the middle. What was interesting was the drummer was playing this rhythm on the tom-toms, which I thought was cool, and it gave this sort of like almost like a conga groove, but it was played with sticks on the toms.
Yeah, I love it when drummers do that. Honestly, it sort of it gives it this energy. I mean, the song can sound really laid back, but underneath it there's this like energy running it.
Yeah.
It's like this electric bass to a breezy sort of atmosphere.
Yeah. And I always like that the fuzzy guitar tone of T-Rex. And I have a feeling we're going to be hearing a lot of it throughout the album.
No, I think so too. This is Goliam.
Yeah.
This is I believe it's Mark Bolan and his he had a Les Paul burst at this point. Oh, I'm guessing that's what we're hearing.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Moving on to the next song is called Cosmic Dancer. I dance myself right out the womb. I dance myself right out the womb. Okay, there was a lot going on there.
I have heard that one before.
Yeah. It started off pretty slow, towards the end, I was... Well, okay. I wasn't really expecting the string section. That was interesting. It seemed like it was a bit, it could have been a bit over the top, but it wasn't.
No. As far as like doing like an orchestration, it came off still very, not overproduced. It wasn't overdone. It wasn't, ostentatious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you had the backwards guitar at the mm-hmm. end there.
That was cool. Yeah.
That was really cool. And I wasn't, and again, it's something that, shouldn't fit, but it does.
Yeah. Especially when the rest of it's, acoustic guitar driven with an orchestra behind it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was partly the drums, they weren't quite as, conga rhythm as they were before, but there was still that sort of element. It was slowed down a bit, but it was still carrying it through, and that did help blend it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, the drums were definitely doing some interesting stuff. They weren't just playing a straight, four on the floor beat. The drums were doing exactly what the song called for. They weren't overplaying, but they weren't just playing a simple beat either. They kept it interesting. I think all the instruments were doing something interesting. They weren't just playing the song, but they weren't showing off either. They were playing whatever the song called for. They were playing to serve the song, but they were also doing something interesting at the same time, which is really hard, a really hard balance to do.
Yeah.
So I don't actually know that much about T-Rex. Was it just Mark Bolan and a bunch of studio musicians, or were they an actual band?
I'm pretty sure he had a band.
Okay.
I'm not that familiar with either, but I would always assume he had a band. He certainly had a group of musicians he toured with. I don't remember their names. I'm sure there were some familiar people in there, and it's not coming to me at the moment, but
so I'm,
it's just me today.
So I'm just reading the album credits here. So T-Rex is a band, Mickey Finn on congas, bongos, and vocals. Steve Curry on bass guitar, Bill Legend on drums and tambourine. This is something interesting and something I didn't know. You might know this, is Rick Wakeman played keyboards on Get It On.
Hmm. No, I did not know that. That's very interesting and totally a little is not what he's known for.
No.
Is doing stuff like that.
No.
He's way more flamboyant on his playing in most, especially with Yes.
We'll talk about that when that song comes up. But interesting. I did not know that, and I was not expecting that. But anyway, let's get into the next song, which is called Jeepster. So that was interesting. That almost had like a country feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the intro almost sounded like something that came like 9 or 10 years later, like a new wave thing. And then it went into this country vibe, which I was not expecting that transition.
Yeah. It's funny. Glam is sort of like a predecessor to like punk and even new wave in a lot of ways. There's a lot of parallels there. And it came out of acid rock and proto punk and yes, even the psychedelia, like the backwards guitar, which we heard earlier.
Yeah.
It's a pretty straight line. I mean, there's a couple of, actually proto punk and proto metal were almost the same genre before they split off and late 70s.
Yeah.
So, they weren't really known that. They were just rock.
Yeah, and you can sort of follow the line of like proto-punk with bands like The Stooges and MC5 and bands like that. And then going into glam rock, you have bands like the New York Dolls, who are sort of in between glam and punk. And then you have the New York punk scene that kind of took over the late 70s. So there's a very like straight line you can draw between.
Yeah, but it was also a UK punk scene at the same time. So, and lots of glam bands from the UK as well. So there was a, they shared a, quite a culture between New York and London around that period.
Yeah. And it's interesting to hear this album incorporate so many genres like that. That was, but it was country, but in a glam rock sort of way, and also putting T-Rex's stamp on it. Like it sounds like even if you didn't hear the vocals, you would go, "Oh, that kind of sounds like T-Rex," but it's a country song as well. Like, or not a, I wouldn't classify it as country. I'd say it would have a, it has a country feel.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a country structure sort of, but it's also a blues structure in a lot of ways. But yeah, it's that sort of honky tonk, sort of structure actually.
Yeah.
So you would hear it from guys like, Duane Eddy back in the early '60s or something like that. So that's where actually, apparently he was a really big fan of, Chet Atkins and Duane Eddy and stuff like that, which is why, well, after his Les Paul got, it was in his trunk, and he got, someone smashed into the back of him and it smashed up the Les Paul, but he had it repaired and he had it sprayed orange because he liked, the Gretches that, Chet Atkins had with the orange. So that's why he sprayed it that, because he was a fan of those guys.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's cool, and that makes sense. That and instead of having like that twangy guitar, they put the fuzz guitar and strings on it. To make it his. He did that to make it his own.
Of course.
One of the things that I read about this album earlier is what T-Rex was before they sort of went into this, and this album was a departure. They were really more of a folk band. What the goal of this album was to take some of the folk lyrics of the hippie psychedelic stuff of the, or the folk scene rather, and take the lyrics, but have it in just like an old fashioned rock and roll setting. That was the goal of this album.
Okay.
And I think they're somewhat accomplishing it, but they're also kind of creating something new. They're not new, but they're doing their own thing with it as well. They're not just copying 50s rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah, they've clearly got their... it's still a very 1970s approach to a 50s, again, structure of rock and roll.
Yeah. Okay, so let's hear the next one, which is called Monolith. From whence you know, we all do begin. I would describe that as psychedelic glam doo-wop.
Yeah, it sort of definitely sort of fits in that thing, but in all those categories that fits into what he was planning on doing with the album, that like that basically is him succeeding in his goal.
Yeah, that's the goal of this album, firing on all four cylinders.
Yeah. Or eight. Or what size engine are we?
Yeah. 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 That was an interesting song. I liked to. Again, this he's using the strings a lot on this album, which I was quite surprised by. Like, I didn't think I would be hearing that many string arrangements on all these songs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of, that's a very interesting choice to make, production choice to make for an album like this. But it does, again, it seems to work. And you can sort of hear the beginning of that real glam rock production sound where everything is sort of dry, but, well, maybe the word isn't dry. There's like a, everything's got a very presence to it, but there's definitely that reverb going behind, especially in the rhythm section or the drums anyway, where everything's
that
kind got
of
that
slap back.
Yeah, the slap back echo. But everything's still got this presence to it. Nothing seems like way back in a hallway.
Right.
No, certainly no gated reverb or anything like that. But oh, that's another decade ahead.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I know what you mean. It has that 1970s dry sound to it, all the instruments are right in the foreground. Like it's all right in your face.
Yes.
I think really you have Ringo Starr to thank for that. I think because on Let It Be and on Abbey Road, he was deadening his drums by putting like towels on them and getting that really dry sound.
Yeah, but also think of the drums in Dear Prudence. Like even the song starts up before the piano even comes in, you can hear that slapback echo on a really dry drum.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's
it's
all tied together.
Well, I guess I should give credit where it's due. You wouldn't, Ringo had something to do with it, but I guess that would be Jeff Emmerich doing that, wouldn't it? So the next song is called Lean Woman Blues. I like that title. So let's hear it.
Well, you're the love of my life, and then you gorge me with a knife, and I'm blue. That's untrue.
I guess that was sort of a loose jam kind of thing.
Yeah.
I like the way he was singing. It was done like almost tongue in cheek, like with a sense of humor. I thought that was, it was just funny. You know, really good guitar playing in that one too.
Yeah. Going a little bit closer to the blues there, but yeah, you can hear it still in that classic rock and roll sort of tradition, but with a very modern for the 1970s sound.
Yeah. I would like to hear a live version of that, because I'm thinking maybe they did and maybe they didn't, but it would be interesting to hear if they just kind of jammed on that for a while.
Mm.
And if they dragged it out to like 10 minutes or something like that.
I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere.
It probably is. I would like to hear that. If they did it, I don't know if they did. I've never heard a live version of that or anything, but that would be cool. And it's an easy song to jam to. And it would be a lot of fun to jam and maybe add some more parts to get some keyboard players in there. Maybe a Fender Rhodes to do some cool stuff.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's a pretty simple song. I don't really have much else to say about it.
Yeah. It's fine.
So we're going to listen to the next song, which is a song. This is probably the biggest hit that they had. It's Bang a Gong, Get It On. Mm. I think it's called Bang a Gong in the States and Get It On in England. It's called Bang a Gong in the States to avoid confusion with a song of the same name by the group Chase. I didn't know that. Mm. I knew there was two different titles, but I didn't know the reason. But,
okay.
Anyway, this is Bang a Gong, Get It On.
Well, you're built now, they call you, got a hubcap, diamond star halo. You feel like a car out, yeah.
I'm I'm still trying to figure out what a hubcap diamond star halo is, but
yeah, it was the 70s. You don't ask these questions.
No, you just go with it.
Yeah.
So yeah, Rick Wakeman played on that.
Hmm. Interesting.
I guess he was playing the piano. The only keyboard that I can really hear, unless there's a Hammond organ in there that I'm not. That's just kind of buried to support the other instruments.
He must have done this just between bands, doing some session work before he went and joined Yes. Because,
well, when did he join Wes? Wes.
Right about this time.
Yeah.
So,
well, I was just reading. Yeah, he must have been just hanging around because the track was recorded. This is on Wikipedia. The track was recorded at Trident Studios in London, and the piano on the record was performed by either Rick Wakeman or Blue Weaver.
Mark, I don't know who Blue Weaver is.
Mark Patris notes that both pianists have played separate parts on the song, with Wakeman contributing only the piano glissandos.
Hmm.
Well, so I guess he may or may not have played on it, I guess.
Well, he played a part of it.
He played a part of it, yeah. Interesting. So I always liked that song. And I can,
me too.
I can definitely see why it was chosen as the single from the album. It's definitely the most radio friendly and made it most catchy. And it sounds like the song they spent the most time on.
Yeah, it sounds more put together than a lot of other things. That's not to say the album is really all loosey goosey, but it really does sound a little more.
It sounds more full. There's a lot of overdubs on this.
That saxophone is really cool.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, again, where you... the saxophone just fits in there, and you almost don't notice it until you realize, oh, that there's a saxophone, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's funny. They keep a lot of things on the bottom end. Like, they really have filled out the bottom end on the production of this thing, so much so that anything on the upper register and his voice isn't even really that upper register, but compared to what everything else going on, it is that, and the guitar and sometimes the piano. So everything up in the upper register is so sparse that it stands out on top of this just thrumming, moving bottom end. That's just this groove that I guess the average listener might not even know exactly what it is that's going on. They just know their butt's moving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they know that they like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, this song is interesting because, Oasis have a song called Cigarettes and Alcohol that is, I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's a ripoff of this song. it uses the same guitar riff, the same chords. I don't know. I don't think it uses the same melody, but Noel Gallagher knew that he was doing it when he wrote that song too. I don't know if he knew the legal ramifications of doing that, but it's interesting that this song has gone on to have the influence that it has. I know so many. I think this might have been the first exposure a lot of people had to glam rock was this song. Because when, like, Bowie came out a few years after this, or his Ziggy Stardust thing was after
this. Yeah, Ziggy Stardust would have come around, I think it was like 71, 72, something like that.
Yeah.
Can't remember. Don't hold me to that. I don't remember exactly what year that came out. But David Bowie was doing stuff. His first solo album came out like, what, 67, 68?
Yeah.
It's almost completely forgotten.
Yeah, and he was more of a folk singer.
Yeah, sort of. He was almost like, he did sort of like, like a Harry Nilsson almost sort of a thing. Before Harry Nilsson decided he was going to do like completely bonkers Monty Python-y sort of stuff. But yeah, but before that, there was he was in other bands with he was known as Davy Jones. Mm-hmm. That was just his name. He switched it because there was already a Davy Jones in the Monkees, and B, it's just, you know, it's a rather kind of whatever name.
It's an ordinary name, yeah.
Yes, he wanted it to stand out more.
Yeah,
but he was in there was like Davy Jones and the. I can't even remember the name of his other bands. It was two other ones that he had in like the mid 60s. So he was a front man for.
Yeah. But that was all before his glam stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is a lot of, I don't want to say that T-Rex invented glam rock, because I don't know. But yeah. I think this is, I really don't know much about glam rock. I don't really know the origins of it. But I think this might have been the first hit in the glam rock scene.
Probably. The first major hit. Well, I think the New York Dolls, when did they first do stuff? I think they were doing stuff around this period, too.
Yeah, but I don't think they had...
But they weren't mainstream.
Exactly.
Also, the MC5, if you ever saw footage of them when they're actually performing, they look pretty glam. Even in the late 60s.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because when the music doesn't, is pretty hard.
Yeah.
And
but it's interesting. When their album came out back in the USA, there was a problem in the production. It came out sounding much thinner than the band generally sounds. But that thin-ish sound, which they became known as the Tiny Roar, became very influential in the punk production. They kind of used that right through, and yeah, you kind of know the sound I'm talking about.
Yeah. I think
if you ever listen to the album,
no, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's interesting. I didn't know that about the MC5. I didn't.
Yeah.
My vision of them, I really don't know what they looked like. I only know the music, really. I've seen a few pictures, but the image that I have in my head is this, like, not like rough guys, you know, like
they could be sort of roughish at times, but if you ever saw a video, like there's really good footage of, the Beat Club, those German TV things, which are all over YouTube, thankfully. Holy crap. Really amazing footage. Full color, everything, and these, I think this was taken around 1970, this footage, and you should see them, like, Rob Tyner's full sequins, everything.
Just, oh, wow.
He's got this jacket on. I've seen other footage where they were playing at the Detroit Ballroom, where I think it was Fred Sonic Smith was, like, he almost, like, dressed as a robot. So they could be pretty wild, in their dress. Really wild in their sound and really wild in their dress. They were all out there.
See, so. that is interesting, because I have, when you describe EMC5 as a proto-punk band, my vision in my head is they're very stripped down, very ordinary, you know, the image anyway is very, like, didn't really care necessarily what they looked like. It was more about the music, like the ethos of punk rock of the late 70s.
And honestly, I think that was sort of part of it. They didn't care what they looked like. They could be goofy in the way they looked and didn't feel weird about it.
Yeah.
It was, there wasn't a defined image. There was just they sort of coined the term punk rock because people called them punks.
Right.
But at the same time, when punk rock became this real, like, minimalist movement in rock and roll, the MC5 were, you had, like, Wayne Kramer could blow, you know, play circles around all sorts of different guitar players at the time, and he soloed, and sometimes they did really long jams. And they did really long solos.
Yeah.
Stuff that punk became like the antithesis to.
Right.
They never lost their energy when they were doing it, though.
Cool.
That's just sort of what it is. Anyway, we seem to have gotten off track of T-Rex.
Yeah. So getting back to this album, so the next song is called Planet Queen. So let's hear that. The world's the same, I am to blame. She used my head like a revolver. The world's the same. Probably the most laid-back song about alien abduction I've ever heard.
Yeah. Pretty well. He seems to be pretty into it, too.
Yeah. not only is he nonchalant about it, he's actually kind of excited.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the conga groove with the drums in there, in the acoustic guitar.
Yeah, that's some of their folk roots coming back out.
Yeah.
In that, you can sort of hear. But again, it still chugs along, although not in like a 50s rock kind of way. It's definitely, it feels more of its time.
Yeah.
But there is that sort of psychedelic folk thing going on underneath for sure.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me of some of the, I guess, more roots rock stuff, maybe like something that the band would do. Not the lyrics at all, but the music itself is maybe influenced by the band a little bit. I don't know. Well, I don't know if it's influenced, but it sounds like it. It's very similar to that.
The band was very influential around this time. I mean, the Basement Tapes had already been cycling around for a while. So yeah, there was definitely a lot of influence coming from those guys. You'd find it in weirdest places on both sides of the ocean.
Not surprising that that they would have an influence. I really don't know if that is, but I would guess that would be the influence on this song.
Yeah, could be.
It was a interesting song. Don't have too much else to say about it.
No, it's just, you know, we've already kind of established our thoughts on like the production. If something else pops out, we'll mention it. But yeah.
So, the next song is called Girl.
Oh God, high in your fields above us, come and be real for us. Are you with your mind? Oh yes, you are.
Talk about minimalism.
Yeah. I like the way that the trumpet it started out quiet in the background and then slowly started to have more presence.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end, it was basically taking over.
But not unpleasantly so.
Right.
Yeah, it's just an acoustic guitar, really. And I don't think there's really much else going on behind other than his singing.
No. And, you know, it's that's all the song needs.
Yep. Doesn't need anything else.
I think if you were to put drums on it or a bass, I don't think it would have been. I think because I think the lyrics are the most important part of this song. And I think if you were to add anything else, it would kind of distract from that. So if you were to put drums and bass on it or, you know, even an electric guitar accompanying it, which they did at the end, they added that at the end.
Fuzz came in, yeah.
But if that had been playing throughout the whole song, I don't know if it necessarily would have worked.
Yeah. It certainly wasn't necessary. I mean, they might have been able to make it work, but they didn't need to take it there.
Right.
So.
And it only came in after all of the lyrics of the song were finished, and it was just the outro. Which just kind of lifted everything up and gave
The trumpet.
Yeah. You know,
try not to let the trumpet take all the spot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it just gave this, it gave it a grand finale.
Yeah, it sort of gave it this final texture that sort of actually backed up the trumpet more than anything.
Yeah.
So, and I noticed this song made me realize that a lot of this album, I mean, the intro is what triggered it because it sounded a little bit like the Kinks. Lola just a little bit. And then I'm thinking there's lots of, you know, it sounds again kind of Bowie-ish, but I'm noticing a lot of like influences of, you know, Kink's earlier stuff and even like the Small Faces mm-hmm. and you sort of hear throughout this. It's and other bands kind of like that. You can definitely sort of hear that influence amongst, you know, what they're doing, which I guess makes sense. They're from that, they came just after that whole scene. So yeah.
I can definitely hear the Kinks influence, especially the way he's singing is a lot or very similar to Ray Davies. I think the Kinks had a lot more influence on British bands than they did and on American bands.
Yeah. They got a little bit of they had more of a cult following on this side of the ocean. But they weren't completely unknown. And of course they had really two really big hits in the mid-60s with You Really Got Me and
All Day and All the Night.
All Day and All the Night. Yeah, those two. But they had a whole roster of hit songs in Britain, and they were more than just, you know, that raunchy fuzzy sound that we were so familiar with over here. So we didn't even get another taste of them until Lola hit the radio, really.
Yeah.
But they had lots of great stuff.
And I think maybe that was just the Americans being so overwhelmed with the amount of British bands that were coming up.
That's partly it. And plus there's enough stuff coming from home as well. That's just the way it works.
Yeah.
I mean, and not everybody's going to make their way over here. Some of their records will, and those in the know will go, hey, this is great, listen to this. But it didn't reach anybody else until the internet could, you know, megaphone it to, you know, decades later.
Yeah.
Or through a Nuggets collection in like the late 80s, early 90s.
Right. Yeah. Well, in the Kinks case, I think a lot of it too, they had a lot of influence, a lot of like indie pop bands.
Yeah.
I know a lot of those type of bands cite the Kinks as a mm-hmm. big influence. But again, we've gotten a bit off track.
What is it about all these modern tights that always go bagging in the knees? Bring back the old canvas ones, I say.
Anyway. So the...
Seem to have wandered a bit.
The next song on the album is called The Motivator. So I really liked the bass and drums and the congas and the tambourine combination.
Yeah.
And that really grooved very nicely.
There's an interesting thing about this song. I think he wound up doing some really neat things with it, but it did sound to me like this is a song where the record company went to them and said, oh, get it on. That's a great song. Give me another one like that.
Yeah.
And he went, I guess.
Yeah, that's possible. And,
but he still wound up doing some neat stuff with it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a complete throwaway, but you could definitely tell, like, I guess we got to do this again.
I can see that. Especially with a title like The Motivator. I can see that. I never thought about that, but I can see that. I heard the similarities between that and Get It On, but mm-hmm. I just figured that's just his writing style. Maybe I'm less cynical than you are. I don't know.
I'm not really that cynical about it. It's just something that's like hot. It's just like, you know, I know this happens, and that sounds like a pretty evident one to me. But again, I'm not actually trying to put it down. It's just the origin of it, I am guessing, because it's just the motivator, and it goes right into it, and it sounds like, okay, yep, this is very much a similar song. He did change it up, that those cellos going in the outro and the harmonica in there were neat little textures, and he decided to go a little different there. But yeah, no, it's there's even some of the lyrics weren't exactly you know, terrible either or anything yeah. like that. He's just again, just sort of giving it his own flavor, but it really does sound like that song was a commission.
I can see that. I can see that. Because, yeah, I think maybe the record company heard the album and they said, well, we need another song. We need another, you know, maybe the
or the single came out and they decide, well, we want at least another one of those on.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah. And they kind of back them into a corner. Yeah, that kind of thing happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the cellos, and I think I hear I wouldn't be surprised if that was an influence from the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations. And the cellos in there. I recently watched a movie about Brian Wilson. It's a biography called Love and Mercy, and there's a scene in there where they're recording, because in the song Good Vibrations, there's a part where the cellos are just chugging along and they're kind of take over, and there's a scene in there where it's them in the studio recording that song and Brian Wilson working with the cello players, getting them to do this chugging rhythm over and over and over again for like 3 hours until it sounds exactly how it is in his head.
Is that the one with Paul Dano? And
Yeah,
that's a good movie. I like that one. John Cusack.
John Cusack.
Really good music.
Movie. Yeah, So my main point was I think the cellos in this song were influenced by the song Good Vibrations. I wouldn't, and that's again like Brian Wilson had a huge influence, especially on producers. So I wonder if Tony Visconti, the guy who produced this album, was influenced by that, by putting the cellos on there.
Could be.
Yeah. So we've got two more songs on the album. So, the next song is called Life's a Gas.
Life's a gas. I could have built a house on the
Very ocean. Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's probably the second best song on this album.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got to give the nod probably to, Get It On, Bang A Gong, but this is a close number two. It's a very, it's a well-written song, and it's got a really pretty vocal melody. It's just, this is a really high quality to the writing even before the production and instrumentation comes into it.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's one of the best written songs on the album. And the production is really great too. It's a little more sparse than the other ones, but it still works. And there's something about an acoustic guitar paired with an electric guitar with distortion that for whatever reason, it always sounds good together.
Yeah. You have mentioned this a few times in the past. Yeah. It is a really interesting thing. I also thought it was really interesting. Like I wasn't aware that the technology existed, but there seemed to have been some sort of like octave effect on the guitar. It sounded really cool, but 1971, that kind of surprises me a bit.
I wonder if it was even a guitar. I wonder if it was, because it almost sounded like a clavinet.
It was a guitar. It sounded like a guitar to me, but I'm wondering if maybe it was a production trick, too. He might have taken the track, doubled it up, and shifted it in the studio.
Oh, I'm just wondering. Possible. I don't know if that would necessarily have been possible.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Because you would have to, in order, because they're working with tape, and the only way that you can lower the pitch in tape is to slow it down. So,
I have no idea. Yeah. That's why I'm trying to figure out how the heck did they get that octave effect.
Yeah.
but it wasn't a clavinet.
Okay. Yeah, I, well, so when was the first octave pedal?
I would imagine it probably came about, you know, with the advent of digital recording technologies, the first examples of that. And this is after analog, you know, modular synthesizers and stuff like that.
Okay, well, it's telling me that the first octave pedal was in 1982. Octave effect boxes are a type of special effect unit. One of the first popular musicians to employ the octave effect was Jimi Hendrix. So I guess it has been okay. around.
Yes, the Octavia was something that Jimi Hendrix would actually use. It's true. I don't know how the technology worked, but he did actually use it.
Yeah.
That's right.
That must be what they're using.
Gotta be. Well, what else was there?
Yeah, that would have been the only option.
But it sounds so very clean. I mean, it's fuzzy and distorted, but the difference between the two tones is so well defined. There's no mud in between.
Right.
I thought it was really interesting.
And it's not doubled up by like with the bass or anything because it's too precise to be doubled with another instrument.
It doesn't sound too much like a double track.
No.
If it was, damn, they're right on key.
Yeah.
right on beat.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It is a little. I suspect that someone's tweaked an octavia to really come out as clean as they could possibly get it. That's about all I can think.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, because they're definitely not pitch shifting with in the studio because there would be no way to do that.
No, it's not. It's not certainly not a tape thing that they're doing.
Because, the only way to do it would be to slow down the tape, and you could do that, but then how do you also get the high note at the same time? Like, there would be no way to do it.
Yeah, unless you played twice.
Yeah.
But
it's too precise.
One's really fast and one really slow.
Yeah, but it's too precise to be
played. Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's not double tracked.
Nope. Huh. It is really interesting.
Yeah.
Another thing about the song, I was mentioning the vocal melody and stuff like that. It's the song didn't need it, and they obviously opted not to do it. But I think it would be kind of neat to hear a harmony vocal.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess T-Rex just wasn't doing that. I can't think of any when they ever used that. They used backup singers, but they didn't use like a harmony vocal.
Yeah, because the other singer, I think it's Mickey Finn. They're just singing in unison,
mm-hmm.
Here and there. There's no harmony. But I think you're right. I think another high harmony would have sounded really cool on this mm-hmm. track. I don't know if it would have worked on all of them.
No. But yeah, this track just was sort of. I mean, ultimately. The song is fine without it. I'm not actually putting it down or anything like that. I just heard in my head a place where a harmony could be, and it would have been cool to hear that at some point. I don't know. Maybe someone's done it.
Yeah. So we've arrived at the last song on the album, and the last song, the album closer, is called Rip Off. So that was kind of the perfect album closer because it basically had all the elements of the album that we had heard so far all mashed into one song.
Yeah. It was it was definitely a punkier approach. So you can definitely again feel the tie in there.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, like the way the horn section was being used. was very much in line with what you would hear with some other glam bands. And the Rolling Stones around this time was doing that. They were basically a glam band at this point.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if this point, they certainly, by 1972, they were.
Well, think of Sticky Fingers. They were still doing.
Yeah, I suppose.
It was in line.
Yeah.
But yeah, they definitely flew way head first into it around 72. And certainly by, you know, Girls, Girls, Girls. And even they started to go back to their roots again by the time. Oh, what's the one? I'm trying to think of Exile on Main Street and stuff like that. So.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely the angriest song on the album.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think it wraps up the album really well, because it
ended just on that cacophony thing.
Yeah.
Going, yeah.
And it just has everything the album, every kind of element that we've heard in the album so far was in this song. They had the string section, they had the fuzz guitar, acoustic guitar, the congas, saxophones, like everything was in this song.
Yeah.
I really like this album.
Oh, it's fun for sure.
I'd never heard this album from start to finish. I always knew the hits. I knew like Bang a Gong and 20th Century Boy. I think that's the name of the song.
Yeah, I don't think it's on this album.
It's not on this album, but that's another one of their big hits. So I knew those songs, but I never really paid too much attention to them. And I certainly never heard this album from start to finish. And I really like it.
Yeah, it's a good album. It is quality. But yeah, I especially loved the, of course, we all love Bang a Gong, but I like Life's a Gas, and there's a few other really good ones on there as well. It's pretty well put together, I think.
And I think I can see why this was the jumping off point for a lot of people for the glam rock stuff that would, you know, basically take over rock and roll for the next two or three years.
Yep.
I don't know what else to say about this album other than it's great. I'm not that surprised that I like it, but I was pleasantly unsurprised, I guess.
It met
my expectations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing sucks worse than listening to something, you getting all excited about something, you put it on, and it's just like, oh, well, this is not great.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Honestly, it doesn't happen that often.
It doesn't happen that often.
I don't get that disappointed with something, because I like to go into it with an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't happen to me too often when I put on something that I was really expecting and then being sort of disappointed.
Yeah.
It's happened once or twice, but even in those cases, sometimes it had to grow on me just because what I was hearing was so unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Yeah. So, that's T-Rex Electric Warrior. And if there's nothing else, that's it for the show for this week. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a great week. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.